All lines are now bridged.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome again to the ICAD Task Force. Quick roll call of our task force members, and then we'll get started. Cheryl Turney?
Present.
Alex Goss?
Present.
Erin Meary? Abby Sears? Alexis Snyder?
I'm here.
Mandy Trescott?
Present.
Anil Jain?
Present.
Arian Malik indicated he would be absent. Deb Strickland?
Here.
Denise Webb?
Here.
Josh Shirashi?
Here.
Jackie Monson?
Here.
And James Pantello said he would be absent as well. Jim Gerges?
Here. Present.
And Jocelyn Keegan?
Here.
Great. Les Leonard? Either Mary Green or Alex Muggy in CMS. Ram Sriram?
Present.
Rich Landon?
I'm here.
And Sasha Termot?
Present.
Steve Brown? Tom Mason?
I'm on.
Okay. I think that's it. I will now turn it over to Alex to do a bit of a summary and action items.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you doing the roll call, and thanks for people joining in today. We are going to do a little bit of a background, kind of just refresh ourselves on last call and the game plan for today. Then I'm going to lead us into a discussion with a small group participating that took a look at the guiding principles and ideal state table since last call. Cheryl and Josh will lead us through a discussion of the data classes and categories table as a follow-up, and then we want to have a brief discussion around some demonstrations and activities for next steps before we take public comments. So that gives us an agenda for today. If we want to go ahead and summary and action plan is our next item. So let's go to the next slide, please. Thank you. So at the last call, we took a deep dive into the prior authorization information table or workbook, specifically the tab around the data classes. They really evolved the framework for the data classes into a new sort of structure that aligns with USCDI that really seemed to seemed to resonate on the last call for folks. And we had some additional work that was done, and we'll be here showcasing that in the second half of today's call. We also discussed the work of the Happy Path group. That's really about the guiding principles and ideal state tab within our overall workbook. We had some great discussion around started some great discussion around the initial content that had been submitted, and we want to pick up with a continuing review of that content today. We also, at the last call, wrapped it up with a set of detailed comments from the American Medical Association, CoverMyMeds. We're anticipating being able to distribute the detailed comments from AMA as they've submitted those in writing. So we'll get those out to everyone after the call. But what I think is really nice to see is that we've rolled up our sleeves. We're starting to really give shape to the content in the workbook, and industry is starting to help us with some additional thoughts and considerations as we move through our body of work. I'm getting a fair amount of background noise. I'm not sure if that's me or... So the approach for today's call, as I noted, was that we were going to spend our time in the workbook today. We are going to start with number two, guiding principles and ideal state, then the data categories. But Cheryl, I think we wanted to make a comment around some of the content you've been adding in recommendations. Do you want to describe that new sub-bullet to item four?
Absolutely. So for the group, both in the other considerations tab as well in the recommendations tab, I've been going back through presentations that have been made to HITECH through various meetings that we've had over the past year and adding placeholders, if you will, of things that we may want to review or consider that have come up as a result of the presentations that have been made describing the burdens, and some of them included recommendations, some of them included considerations. So what I have done is just try to extract out of all of those artifacts the considerations that were brought forward, as well as the recommendations, without trying to edit them myself. So when it's appropriate with the timing of this work that we're doing, we will then start looking at considerations and the recommendations, and then we can decide to edit out some of these things. But I have included in the references not only what the recommendations were, but the document that they came from, the group that put the document forward, and the date that document was presented to either the ONC or HITECH. So that way, if there were questions, we would be able to link back to the source document. So people will see over the next, not done with all of this, there's more work that needs to be done, but I will be completing that work hopefully by the end of this week. And then when we get to reviewing that data, as we try to bring all of these things into our recommendations paper, we can at least evaluate what some of our stakeholders who've come to ONC and HITECH have already recommended, to see whether or not those are appropriate, how we want to frame those out.
Thank you for that update, Cheryl. I believe also, in addition to your work to extrapolate prior HITECH content and recommendations, we'll also have an update on the compendium coming out shortly as well, that will just add in some of the other industry artifacts that were suggested. Like I believe there was on the last call several recommendations to tap into the Da Vinci guiding principles. So we wanted to make sure to give a link to folks out there as well. So with a wee bit of setup there, what I'd like to do is suggest that we roll up our sleeves and dive into the guiding principles and ideal state discussion. If we could have Josh start to screen share, that would be great. So, there we go. So this past Monday, several of us gathered to take a look at the Happy Path table, the guiding principles and ideal state, and want to do a shout out to Anil, Alexis, and Tom Mason that joined me to work on this tab. Specifically, we took a look at two things. First was the content that I had added previously from the Weedy paper, and we cleaned that up, started reworking that content a little bit, and that was a nice setup for today's discussion because we didn't get to look at that on last call. We ran out of time. And the other thing we looked at was the guiding principles from the Clinical Advisory Council of the Da Vinci Project to see what content we might be able to incorporate into this tab. So I've invited Anil and Tom and Alexis to join in rounding out our content here today. What I'm hoping is that we can present to you the work that we've done and then advance it, and hopefully we'll be able to capture all of that on the fly, and if not, we'll have the transcript to aid our work. One of the things that we started with was the guiding principles, and although we looked at the guiding principles of the Clinical Advisory Council, we found a lot of those might actually be beneficial to our ideal state. One of the things that we noted is that there's a commonality of concern around the concept of minimum necessary restrictions. I'm on row 8, and we decided to revise the language for minimum necessary restrictions accounted for as a guiding principle, and I wanted to propose for consideration a reword to minimum necessary information that is agreeable to 1, HIPAA, 2, local and state laws, and 3, data usage agreements and business associate agreements. open it up for comments from those in the meeting if you have anything to say, or raised hands from those who might want to ask a question about that proposed reword.
So the Alex, this is Cheryl, and I didn't raise my hand, but I did have one suggestion, because I know this came up in other meetings with other stakeholders, but we know that there already exists in some cases conflicts between HIPAA and data use agreements and business associate agreements. So when you're referring to this as a minimum necessary, you're just really talking about the minimum necessary required by, you know, whatever that data share is.
I think the concept is that we want to be mindful to only share what we really need to share. So there will be some work that happens in the standards development world for the implementation guides that does some data requirement gathering at that level and gives us a framework for information. But then when systems or people need to add content, they need to be using the lens to supply only that which is required as the minimum necessary to perform the business function. And so that is really governed by HIPAA as law of the land with minimum necessary, further influenced by the legal frameworks of states and business associates. And so we wanted to put in there that concept that there was sort of a scale of considerations related to minimum necessary, and that those are sort of outside of our realm of control. There might be something that we want to address related to that, but for right now, that's how I'm viewing our modifications. Would others like to add color commentary on that?
Yeah, this is Anil. I think you said it well, Alex. Cheryl, I mean, we have to admit that the easy thing to do is to send an entire packet of data in order to satisfy some sort of, EPA type of mechanism. But we really want, just as Alex said, it to be a thoughtful minimum necessary. And to give you an example of something that might be influenced by local and state laws, there could be STD testing in adolescents. If you don't need that information, let's make sure it doesn't become part of the packet of data that's sent over. And we ought to be really, really careful and make sure that whatever we do, the guiding principle should be minimum necessary, not just by HIPAA, but whatever the local policies are. And then in conjunction with that, to your point earlier, the BAAs that might impact the two entities ought to be reflecting that as well. But we ought not to create a model where it's just too easy to send more information than is necessary.
I absolutely agree with you, Anil. And I guess in my head where I was getting a little bit fuzzy is with the new interoperability rule, where in some cases what you must send is the minimum, you know, version one of the US CDI. What if all that minimum, first set of version one of US CDI isn't necessary for minimum necessary? So how do we reconcile that? That was my only question in my head. Maybe that would never happen. I don't know.
Well, I mean, go ahead. Sorry, Jim.
No, I was just going to say that some of the discussions we had about that in the larger high-tech meeting were about segmentation. So is segmentation a requirement? Because that would get us to the point where you could send subsets instead of the entire US CDI. Yeah, they were talking about a requirement for next version being segmenting data so that you could only send purpose-driven data instead of the whole packet.
Yeah, I think this is Anil. I think that's one mechanism, but even short of that, I don't think the intent was ever that if you have a business purpose that is fairly limited in scope, that the entire US CDI, the entire patients noted into the standards as depicted by US CDI should be exchanged. I think the principle of exchanging what is minimally necessary to do the work is not somehow supplanted by the new interoperability rules. At least that's the way I understand it.
I would agree with that. This is Alex. I would agree with it that there's sort of different wheelhouses and there's an overarching policy objective in the HIPAA and legal frameworks in contrast to the concepts of data availability within the USCDI. And those two should eventually sync up with standards intersecting the two worlds, would be my thoughts. Jocelyn, I see your hand up.
Yeah, I just wanted to share, I completely agree with the conversation where it's headed. We have grappled with this quite a bit as we've been fielding the first couple generations of ballot comments on the DaVinci implementation guides, with everybody really wanting us to solve, you know, the eternity's challenges around data sharing inside our implementation guides. So I've shared the link to the published version of our guiding principles that we use. Our intent is to essentially insert a subset of these principles and then links back to sort of a home page around the principles into all of our implementation guides. But I think it gets at the heart of that last string of commentary. I mean, I see USCDI as really being the floor of content that we want to free and make liquid in the industry. But the role of trading partner relationships and the data being fit for purpose can be narrower or larger than USCDI. It's all about trading partners at a contractual relationship level, deciding what data they're exchanging for what scenarios and making sure that the end user has enough controls in place to validate, review, and look at that data before they, you know, allow, you know, or hit go to be able to share it.
Yep. I have a question, if I could virtually raise my hand.
Sure, I'm sorry, I'm not sure who's speaking.
This is Sasha.
Oh, hi, Sasha.
I was just curious, and maybe this will help me follow what's kind of envisioned with minimum necessary, but if we take a class of data in USCDI, like diagnoses, is the vision for a prior authorization that, you know, a particular user, like the clerk who's filling out a prior authorization, would pick which diagnosis of a list of 20 was relevant for this particular authorization and send just that, or that all the diagnoses would be sent except for particular ones which were marked as sensitive in some fashion, or something else that isn't either of those choices?
Alex, I can speak to that a little bit from a
Division. Yeah, thank you. That would be good, because I was trying to think through that there's a multitude here of the way, if you're doing systems interactions versus whether you're doing human interactions. And so from an automated extraction perspective, DaVinci would be a great perch from which to answer.
And I can wear it with both, try that up from both hats, right? So I think that the sentiment that you're sharing, which is sort of, I'm picking the right diagnosis for the thing I'm doing today versus sending over an entire record of the patient's history for a set period of time, is much more preferable, right, from an implementation standpoint. And those are the active discussions that are happening in the IMP guide work that we're doing, because we want to make sure that the workflow and the content is appropriate for what's going to be happening with the end user that's going to be putting this data in, a nurse, a doc, a MA, right, at the end of the day. And I think that, to me, it's not just necessarily narrowing around the diag code. It could also be a period of time. You could be time bounding it. So not anything that was ever put in the record about this patient, but within the last 6 months, and that those would be parameters, right, that you could set at the UI level, or that trading partners have agreed upon, right, as part of the contractual relationships that they have with each other about what they're going to share.
And Jocelyn, to that end, to what degree does the implementation guide fit into there? Like, how does the implementation start?
What's possible. It literally allows
right.
you to what's possible, but when you're actually putting it into production and agreeing to use it with a trading partner, that's where the rubber hits the road. And I think I'd say philosophically, a lot of the conversations that we've had around this space, and we brought this document to our clinical advisory council that we created last fall, really to get input from docs, you know, sort of across the industry, and nurses and pharmacists. that are on the council. And a lot of the sentiment from those conversations was, you know, we have this desire to want to control things sort of at the API level, but that's not where that content gets controlled today. It literally gets controlled in the relationship documents. And that someday we might live in a world where the APIs are smart enough to be able to control it all, but that the vast majority of that work is done today and will continue to be done at the permissioning and contracts, not at the code level. And when I had this really great testimonial from a number of the physicians and nurses that were deep into informatics, advanced informatics, within these large IDNs, saying that when they did it, when they got really, really specific about it, sort of at the implementation level, it came back to bite them later because it made the data very inflexible for them to repurpose for their own improvement areas at a later point in time because they had so hamstrung themselves sort of to get that control at the code level versus at the contract level.
This is Tom. That's very helpful, Jocelyn. And just to add to the conversation and to also answer in part your question, Sasha, for me, it helps to think about specific examples. And one that was going through my mind was, let's say there was a prior authorization for etanercept for an autoimmune disease. And the requirements would be, let's say, that the patient must have, a diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis, and that within the medication list, there should be evidence of either methotrexate and prednisone as meds that have been during the initial course of medication therapy, or a reason why the patient was contraindicated for those medicines. So I was thinking more of the lines of very specific diagnosis from the record and, you know, very specific medications as opposed to having access to the entire list of diagnoses and medications. But that sort of helps me think about the ideal workflow to adhere to that sort of minimum necessary requirement for information.
So thank you, Tom, for that, because one of the things that I was really appreciative of in our discussion on, gosh, it was just yesterday, about these guiding principles was trying to keep our lens at the right level, and Anil seemed to really help us come back to what is it that we as a task force need to be putting forward. So as I'm thinking about this minimum necessary rewording, you know, we're trying to create sort of these guardrails and framing, but then we've taken a really interesting sort of deep dive into the nuance of a system-to-system exchange or to go into and extract data out and then share it for a prior authorization purpose. So are we feeling that there's this revised guiding principle that we want to capture related to the diagnosis and medication lists? Or is that too detailed for us to get into in these guiding principles? Any thoughts on that?
Well, for me, I think that is a little too detailed. I was just thinking that, you know, using that as an example, because there's so many different types of prior auth that I think we want to try to keep it at a higher level, but still capture the spirit of what we've been, you know, discussing for the past few minutes.
Yeah, that's not a principle.
Jocelyn, I see you have your hand up.
Oh, I don't have a hand up because it's not working. I'm hitting the screen and nothing's
happening. Oh, Andrew, that was great. I got your comment. I just saw she was following up after you. So, so did you still have something to offer on that, or are you just putting your hand back down, Jocelyn? Okay, Anil.
Yeah, I wanted to just to say that I think the guiding principles should be general enough that they can flow from detail to detail to detail, as opposed to being too detail oriented. So I think we're all saying the same thing. It's fine to have examples that clarify the guiding principles, but the guiding principles should be something that we don't need to come back to over and over again as we, you know, hammer out details. This is my perspective.
Okay, so Jocelyn, is your hand back up again?
It is. I was just talking on mute over here.
All right, having fun. You're up
exactly.
Next.
Tuesday afternoon. So I agree. I think that I think the points that Tom made and Anil just made, and I believe the speaker in between, I think that to me, there's so many different variations of how people are going to introduce improved automation, and that I think that the spirit of the principle needs to be around just the right data at the right time and no more, and that makes sense. And that when we get more prescriptive than that, you really get into implementation and you get into the how. And I think we really want to stay at the guiding principle level, up around the idea of sort of how and where should this decision be made, not in the weeds of how it's going to get implemented, because I think that that will handcuff us and make us revisit unnecessarily.
Okay. Thank you for that. I'm going to suggest that seeing no more hands raised. And Andrew, we've been having some other sporadic issues with, like, some people can't see the caption transcript box. So if your hand raising isn't working, just chime in, or anybody else that's having technical issues, assume it's not you and just speak up and jump in.
I will do. And just rest assured, the caption doesn't understand a word I say either.
Okay. It's the accent, maybe. All right. So what I want to propose is that I'm hearing that the minimum row 8 works, but maybe what we need is a guiding principle that underscores the right data at the right time concept that Jocelyn said, with maybe using the example like Sasha brought up to kind of craft a guiding principle there. I'm going to move along if there are no other comments on that, to number 14, if we can. So on row 14, the small group, I believe this, that the standardized minimum data will align with USCDI and will be the basis for data exchange for prior authorization. To that end, if key/priority data is not currently present in USCDI, then the ICAD task force will prioritize feedback to the USCDI task force for consideration in subsequent versions. Any comments on that guiding principle?
Hey, Alex, this is Anil. Can I just clarify something which is not clear in what we wrote yesterday? But we're not suggesting that the minimum data that is being exchanged is the entire USCDI core data. It's just that whatever data gets used should get standardized with the guardrails of the USCDI.
So should we be saying if key priority prior auth data is not currently present? Or is
what I'm getting at is the first part of line 14. The word minimal could be misinterpreted. We're not suggesting that the minimum data for exchange should be the entire what is spelled out in USCDI. It should still, be looking at line 8, but as a minimum. But if you're going to exchange data for the purposes of prior authorization, then the data, we should not be coming up with yet another set of standards. It should be aligned with USCDI.
So the point being is we should delete the word minimal from row 14 in the first line.
I think so. I
agree. I think we were so in the row 8 conversation, we just carried it over. And Jocelyn, I see your hand up. So yes, please delete the minimal. Thank you, Josh. Yes, Jocelyn.
My friends at ONC will chuckle if they hear me talking about this, but there's definitely some resources, at least on the fire side of the world, that need to be matured, I think, to be ready for prime time for USCDI between payers and providers around prior authorization. So I'm more than happy to share what we've learned as we've been working on the prior auth workflows themselves with this group as things that need to be prioritized. And I think that I like to use an example when we talk about the minimal data. I think that I always use the example of somebody that's trying to get a prescription for a human growth hormone. If you ask whether somebody's pregnant or not pregnant and get the right diag code, that's the only information you need to get an automated approval versus having to share a much larger subset of data, right? So in some cases where you can be tactical and precise, you're sharing two or three data points versus, you know, hundreds of data fields about a particular patient to get the approval put into place.
Okay. I'm not sure if there was in the first part of that commentary a guiding principle that you wanted to add, or you were just giving some color commentary. I'm not sure how to process that first part, Jocelyn.
The first piece is just we know there are gaps, and if we need to, when we get into the tactical side of it, I can help share where we found gaps and what we need for USCDF.
All right. Thank you. Any other comments on row 14? Row 15, the small group noted that prior authorization process reform and improvements will be driven by patient safety, evidence-based medicine, and reduced burden. Any comments on that as a guiding principle? Hearing none, I'd like to scroll down so that we have row 17 at the top of the screen, if that'd be possible, Josh. Getting there. Okay. So So on the last call, we briefly touched upon the background information between row 18 and 35. Is that was information that had come from prior discussions or and been captured here. But what we didn't do, if we can scroll to row 37 to the top, is have an opportunity to take a look at the ideal state rows that are highlighted here. These were extracts that were taken from a review of the Weedy white paper. So the first one on row 37, so I'm going to kind of go through these, the first couple ones fairly quickly. The small group of us did discuss these and spent a lot of time really working between rows 42 and 47. But first, let's talk about 37 through 40. The first one, and I'm reading these because we have some people who aren't able to get into Adobe today. So for 37, an ideal state would be that we would increase end-to-end automation for extracting prior authorization data request and response. Pretty straightforward. Any comments on that automation ideal state?
Alex, this is Cheryl. Is there any reason why we have extracting in there? I mean, to me, we need end-to-end of prior authorization, which includes whether or not a prior auth is required. So I'm not sure it reads right if we say extracting.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a reason that I like the word extracting, and maybe it's my focus on that I'm hoping that we have extracting going with the word automation. So what I'm envisioning in the increased end-to-end automation for extracting is that there's an EHR and a payer systems that are interacting, and that for the majority of that interaction, they don't need human interaction to enable that message to be completed, generated, and sent. With that context, how would you modify row 37? Producing? Instead of extracting for producing?
Well, I don't know. I would say for processing because that's what we're talking about. And I don't know. To me, extracting is
processing.
Different. I don't want to pick on words, but.
It's kind of important that because these words matter here. So I'm okay with processing, increase end-to-end automation for processing prior auth data request and response.
Yeah.
Any concerns with making that change, folks?
Processing makes sense.
Awesome. All right, let's change that. Thank you, Josh. Row, sir, I'm going to keep moving along. Feel free to stop me at any point. Row 38, standards adopted to support end-to-end automation. So think of this as saying, if we're going to really want to take a system-to-system processing approach, that we need standards to be recognized for that to occur. Do we need to say national standards? Or standards good enough for folks?
I like the vision.
Okay.
In general, I'm not sure we should be talking about new standards so much as embracing existing as much as possible. I wasn't quite sure what you were trying to achieve with this.
I think that it probably fits in with some of the next couple of rows. So let's talk about the number 39 and 40, because they really fit in here. So row 39 indicates that policy permits use of multiple standards for exchange versus only one standard for data content or data sets and operating rules. So currently we have a pharmacy path and we have a medical path, and we have a ceiling that is currently set, as we're addressing in row 40, that says a policy adopts a floor of standards, not a ceiling. And that we thought should definitely be reworded when the small group met, to say if you create a floor, then innovation leaders will still need to support foundational standards for consistency and practice. So let's take a step back here and think about rows 38, 39, and 40 in kind of a big bucket with different aspects related to our ideal state. Today, for instance, in the medical world, we have a 278 that is the standard for medical prior authorization. That is the ceiling. There has been discussion in the industry that having ceiling standards prevents innovation, and that there could be an opportunity to pivot the way we approach adoption of national standards to establish a floor, the basic minimum that everybody's got to support. There's also been discussion in the industry that we would not just want to say there's only one way to do this, since many of our standards are electronic data interchange-based transaction messaging, in contrast to newer technologies and the direction that we seem to be heading in with a more with the approach with application programming interfaces. So if we could create a floor that supported the 278, for instance, in the medical world, and an API Firebase solution, we might create a foundation that it lets the market figure out what makes best for them in the information exchange and business processing environments. What we could then do is have that floor where everybody has to have a common kind of framework that we operate on, either EDI or API. We could then not prevent the front runners who wanted to evolve the next set of standards and test those out from being blocked from doing so, and being able to support the foundational floor standards as well as providing any of the innovation that they and their trading partners elect to use. That provides color commentary for rows 38 through 40. With the idea of the standards adopted might not be a really good ideal state. It's kind of a simplistic statement, but it really sets the stage and maybe should be replaced by rows 39 and 40. Thoughts on that? is silence endorsement, or is silence that you're all scratching your head wondering what the heck I just said?
No, no, it's catching up.
I like where
you're headed. It's Jocelyn.
Yes, I agree.
Okay, so it's support. Okay, cool.
I agree.
And maybe that it's that maybe what we need to do is clean up 39 and 40. I think we'll have to come back and we'll look at that. So I'll just make myself a note. Okay. All right. So we then, after
hey,
we take, yes, ma'am.
It's Jocelyn. I do want to share, though, having spent some time here, I do think that when you start to call out specific exception processes for particular healthcare professionals, it does tend to act as, let me say, a trigger word for some readers. So I don't know if you guys have spent any time sort of wordsmithing or debating that, if there was discussion in the group sort of calling out specific examples like gold carding, because I just wouldn't want us to use language that would necessarily sort of shut down readers or push them in a more negative bent than media.
Oh, perhaps are you in row 47?
Yes.
Yes, that's interesting. I put it in there, and I was hesitant to put it in there when we were talking yesterday. But yes, it does. Gold carding does have some negative connotations, and I do think we're trying to be sensitive. But it was sort of a shorthand about what that sentence was really, Rosette 47 was getting at. So,
okay, as long as you covered that, then I'm good.
Well, let's come back to that. Okay. Excuse me. So in row 42, we started to look at the consensus positions from January of 2018. And what we did was we broke those. They were originally all bullets within row 42, and we broke them out. So let's go by one by one. So 43, to accelerate industry adoption of national electronic standards for prior auth and improve transparency of formulary information and coverage restrictions at the point of care. From an ideal state, how do folks feel about that row? Any concerns?
Alex, it's Alexis. I think we may have left off perhaps at the end of that sentence, not just coverage formulary information and coverage restrictions at the point of care, but something that is showing that transparency and communication is continuing beyond the original point of care. So maybe like a continuity and transparency as we go along. I mean, I'm not sure how to wordsmith that, but that's my thought anyway, not just point of care, because it doesn't end there.
Alexis, do you mean like the continuity of care to ensure that?
Yeah, not just the continuity of the care, but if we're talking about being transparent about coverage restrictions or formulary information, that it's going to evolve over the process of the steps that the PA is going through. So not just to have an exchange or a transparency of that information right at that point of care, being like, you know, patient visit at the very beginning, but a continuity of communication along the way.
So would it really maybe be a second sentence that says continuity of transparency will be maintained throughout the as a concept throughout the care continuum?
Sure. I mean, you could make it a second one, but if you wanted to keep it smaller, you could just kind of put maybe a semicolon after point of care and add it there. Either way.
Anil, I see your hand up. Anil?
I'm just going to say words. You hear me?
I can now.
Can you hear
me?
Okay. That it's really about, it may start at the point of care, but it's through the plan, right? I mean, I think that's what we're trying to get at. And the words probably don't matter, the kind of care, the treatment plan, continuum, but I think the point being that it's in between the various that a patient may have with their physician. I think that's what I'm hearing. And it's really the treatment plan that make sure that information flows through. And a lot of folks have gold you know, caregiver, HR, or in their EA, other aspect of making sure information patient.
Yeah, and Neil, you are really cutting out. We got about every third word on that one.
Hopefully those were the important words. Let me try calling back in.
Okay. I'm also realizing as I'm looking at the monitor and trying to track this that I realize we're past our allotted time, Cheryl. So we probably need to wrap this up and continue the discussion. So what I think what I would like to do is for row 43, add continuity of transparency beyond the point of care. So we'll figure out how to add that in. And I think, Cheryl, I yield the floor to you for picking up with Josh on the authorization of the table.
All right. I don't know if the I wasn't part of the participating in the group on Monday. I had a conflict. So I'm going to, Josh, let you move over to the table. It looks great. I did look at it earlier today, but I'll let Josh lead the discussion on the table.
Yep. Thanks, Cheryl.
Go ahead.
I'll go ahead and provide a bit of an overview, but Jocelyn, Rom, and I were able to meet earlier, actually a couple times over this past week to kind of iterate on the table a little bit based on the conversation that we had last week as a group. So first things first, just to kind of orient everyone, we got a lot of good feedback on the sort of rearranging of the data elements that we've been discussing in the data class versus data element kind of format. So what we decided to do was for an initial pass at an assessment to start at the data class level, just to kind of make sure we're hitting the high points and setting ourselves up for a future exercise where we might go through more of a data element level to make sure that all the different data needs that we deem necessary for an effective prior auth process are captured in an existing standard. So on the left-hand side, you'll see a list of those data classes. Then across the table, you'll see columns for each of the different standards that we decided to include in the first round of our assessment. And then within each of the columns, we went through class by class to try to identify where we thought there was some usefulness in an existing standard as it pertains to moving data between different actors for that particular data class. We then tried to capture what the capabilities were for each of those standards, and you'll see a table, a legend at the top for the capabilities that we described, ranging from not available all the way to progressing through to emerging capabilities, available capabilities, so something that's fully fleshed out but not necessarily in use in kind of the real world environment. And then lastly, in use, which would be something that's actively being used across the industry today. We then further sliced and diced that assessment by using color coding. So the other legend you'll see at the top is a color coding based on the adoption level that we were able to find for each standard using the ISA that ONC publishes. So we included a few different ranges here. So the kind of low, medium, high grades were where we could individually track something in the ISA using their kind of five-star ranking system and bucket them in a low, medium, high category. Most of what we've seen thus far really fell pretty cleanly into either the low category or the high category. We also have added a couple of different parameters here for standards that were proprietary in nature. So there's some sort of semblance of a standard, but it's not been promulgated through regulation or necessarily drafted, balloted with HL7 or some other standards development organization or accrediting body. And then we also have a draft standard categorization for, like, particularly the fire implementation guides from DaVinci and kind of their progress through the balloting process with HL7. So I'll go through kind of high level this sort of, I guess, heat map might be the best way to describe this that we've developed to this point, and then maybe yield to Jocelyn and Rom to add color commentary before we open it up for comments and feedback. I know there's a couple things in particular we wanted to ask of the group to help us kind of plan for the next step of this. So first you'll see that at a glance there are several standards that prove to be useful in some capacity here for prior auth purposes. I think some things that kind of immediately bubble to the surface is that, and I think this has been reflected in the conversation thus far, is that some of these standards seem to, on their face, prove quite useful in some areas. However, some of those same standards seem to be ones where adoption is lagging. So I think that's where we need to take a step back and kind of analyze why adoption may not be higher in those areas and whether or not those standards may be viable and useful long-term as we kind of plot out what the ideal future state of prior auth looks like. So I think X12 is kind of a good example of that, where we know some of these transaction sets are purpose-built. We've discussed them quite a bit in these task force meetings. However, the 270, 271 transactions for benefits checking are essentially the ones that are have been most readily adopted by the industry. The 278 for prior auth, while it does seem to be purpose-built and has the capabilities that we've discussed as being priority for us, just doesn't have the same level of adoption as the 270, 271, which I don't think is a surprise to anyone, but we're trying to kind of start to paint a picture here to drive some of our recommendations. Moving across the right, so in the NCPDP world for medications, we see the script standard is in use and has high adoption. There's also some work going on that we wanted to acknowledge with the real-time benefits tool, documenting that as kind of the basis for potentially a future standard that's in the works with NCPDP. And so, Jocelyn, I know you had some thoughts on this, and not to interrupt the flow, I don't know if there's any other kind of color commentary you want to provide on that piece before we move on to the fire-related stuff.
Hey, Josh, you're in share screen mode, and you may not have seen that Jocelyn indicated her call dropped, and she would be back,
She's
not answering. Oh, there you go. Okay.
He's doing a great job. He's totally killing it, describing all of our discussion yesterday and last week, but real-time benefit tool or real-time benefit check, however you want to, there's lots of different words for it, has been in pretty significant usage for a couple of years now in the industry. And so I think as we sort of start to judge it against other technologies that are out there, as we move forward with recommendations, I think we're just going to want to make sure that we get a full briefing on sort of where the standard is compared to sort of what we've learned by having standard-like proprietary solutions out there in the market while people are waiting sort of the standards body to catch up with it. So.
All right. Thanks, Jocelyn. We'll move on to the fire-related implementation guides then. So Jocelyn, from her perch at DaVinci, did a lot of work kind of combing through this and making sure we had appropriately captured everything that the DaVinci group is working on right now. And so you'll see here, for the most part, the fire implementation guides are more comprehensive in nature than some of their predecessor standards, like in the X12 world. However, they are newer, and so, adoption is another factor that we wanted to capture to better reflect, how much they're in real-world use today. The other thing I'll mention is in kind of the HL7, CCDA, and V2 world, we did include these as standards that we reviewed in our initial assessment. However, we did not color code these, mainly because we were not confident in their use in the context of prior auth. So there are standards that are primarily for moving clinical data from point A to point B. And given the context of prior auth and transitioning data between providers, payers, intermediaries, PBMs, there's just another kind of wrinkle here that we wanted to capture that was essentially, although there may be a standard, it may not be heavily in use today for prior auth and may not be a strong foundation for recommendations for moving in that direction. So that's kind of the high-level flyby of the work we've done to date. Jocelyn, Ron, anything to add color commentary-wise before we open it up to the group for some questions, comments, and feedback?
I think you did a great job. Thanks.
Yeah, you did a great job, Josh. This is Ram here. On the HL7 CCDA, let me just go back and think about the color coding there, too. Because some of the standards that we talked about in when we said emerging, we had a color code on that as a draft standard. So on HL7, you're right that it's not being used for prior auth, but some of the elements there can be used. So although it's used for other purposes, you could potentially use the CCDA information in a future prior auth whenever they talk about standards there.
I think that this is an important point, and I think it gets back to this idea of sort of everybody's at a different level of maturity with the specific standards that they've implemented and invested in. And, so we've seen progress with folks putting a CCDA inside of a 275 wrapper to be able to share that information, and that is better than a PDF, right, inside of or, an image inside of a 275. But I don't think any of us were comfortable in sort of, if we were going to say CCDA and V2, those are in use across the industry at high volumes, right? But not for this particular use cases. And so I think we're sort of warring with how we want to report out on it, but not underplay the value that these standards have in other workflows out in the market today. So I think that I'd love to hear from this group whether taking that narrower cast of the adoption of these standards for this workflow is the right way to go, or should we come up with some other categorization to show, these are things that are tried and true, but have light adoption in this specific workflow area.
Yeah, Jocelyn, following on the workflow, I think we talked about it yesterday. We have some nice scenarios of the various interactions, then we could essentially place the standards within those scenarios. You remember the workflow diagrams or the event diagrams, actually the agent-to-agent interaction diagrams.
And I think that this is critical. I think that now that we've gotten through this exercise and you guys have laid down
the guidelines themselves, sort of what our operating guidelines are, or guiding principles are, I think that the three of us were very much like, we need to start to draw pictures for roles and actors because there's different types of prior auth that's happening, and how you use and what you can take off the shelf to use at a given point in time is going to vary based on, you know, where we started a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about the complexity and the simplicity of one off versus another, and sort of how episodic it is versus recurring.
So this is Cheryl. I really am happy we're having this conversation about the HL7 and the CCDA. In the high-tech meeting, Ram, you probably were there as well. Leslie Leonard last summer brought up a recommendation that, well, you know, we should just give them all the CCDA and then they have everything and they don't need anything more from us, was his recommendation. And I actually went back and talked to folks inside of Anthem and Blue Cross relative to, you know, have we attempted to try to use the CCDA to address things with prior auth. And most likely the issues we have had have to do with the form in which we've received the CCDA and is it not being structured. But they actually did attempt to do that as part of some of the LPR work we've done with the longitudinal patient record. And because the form in which we were getting it wasn't structured or codified, it really became a humongous lift to try to utilize that CCDA, pull out or extract the appropriate data. So I understand why this has probably not been widely adopted, you know, because certainly that's something that if all the data is there, but I think there's with every interchange, specific reasons why a physician says, well, we need to move to this next step, and these are all the things that we have done as far as this goes. And some of these records are extremely huge, as you know. You know, I would like to have a little bit more conversation around that issue and get the input from what this team thinks, because as I started talking about this more as a concept or an idea, I got more and more pushback from multiple stakeholders as to why it probably wasn't the right way to go. I see Jocelyn, you rose your hand.
Yeah, I think that there's two sides to this coin around sort of the send everything sort of idea with the CCDA that is Maybe if I can share some experience from the NCPDP side of the house, where we've gotten, I think, a really good throughput of automation, in some cases by reducing and removing things like attachments as proof, and really have been working on getting sort of codified values in answers to a question set that can be automated. We've had this really ongoing debate. It's been about 9 months now about expanding the number of attachments somebody can send in with an NCPDP script message to be able to support our friends on the specialty side of the business that aren't as mature and are sort of earlier on that, you know, adoption curve around standards. And how do we sort of serve both those masters? And a number of our PBM partners have actually spoken up and talked about that statistically, they actually see that when providers send more information in, they often give more reasons or more data to be able to cause a denial to happen that is if they had not sent the attachment, that it would have been approved. So I feel like, to me, I think it gets back to that guiding principle around just the minimal amount of data. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't figure out CCDA as a sidecar to a, you know, to a 278 or to a FHIR, you know, implementation guide. Implementation to be able to figure out how to automate. I just think that we want to be very cautious when we think about things in those terms, because the more data we send, the more sort of fuel in some cases you might be giving that person that's doing the determination on the other side, especially in a non-automated world. And when there's data that can't be codified, often that drops to manual review inside these organizations.
Thank you for that input. I see also Ram had his hand up.
Yeah, again, this is Ram here. There are a couple of things here. One is the short-term solution and the long-term. In the short-term, you know, we can send data in the structured format and whatever attribute value players and so on, which you can fill in any of the standards. But again, there is a long-term solution, which I think, especially when you're talking about PA justification, PA response, and those kinds of things. And there's a CCDA has a lot of English language in there, which needs to be parsed and semantically understood. So there needs to be some computer processing out there, you know, using AI technique or natural language processing technique. And then what you do is that you map that into some case frames, which again can go, can easily be computer interpretable. So I would say that one has to consider both this long, short-term and long-term solutions to this. Because it will be pretty easy, especially when you're talking about justifications and those kinds of things. So you take this particular piece from the CCDA or from the EHR, sends the CCDA document to the other side. And then what you do is that there's a template out there at the receiving end, and you can use natural language processing techniques to map this particular text into that template. But the technology is there, it's just that someone has to implement it. I'm done.
I agree, Ram, with what you're saying, because we actually had brought in a natural language processing vendor. And even with that, we were still struggling, again, because the data wasn't codified and we were having to have people translate that data. And that, I don't think that's the appropriate way to do it. Like, the more people touch the data and then translate it, the more likely you are to have things change over time, just like, in my opinion, the telephone game. So I particularly don't like it if we are taking things in and have to transform it, because then that changes it from its original state. And that's not usually good. So, you know, I do think, though, we should include, and I will add as a consideration, that we discussed this conversation about utilizing the CCDA, but really the ideal solution would be to focus on minimum necessary and have that minimum necessary data be codified so that however it's exchanged and operable in both the sending and receiving systems, if there are more than one, then you know, it streamlines the process, because any translation is going to slow things down. But at least we can discuss that we have, you know, discussed this as an option. I think that's going to be required, because when it goes back to HITECH, Leslie is going to bring it up because it was his suggestion last summer. Jocelyn, I see your hand up again.
No, I think it just didn't come down before.
Oh, okay. All right. Anybody else want to weigh in on this conversation? Yeah. I think you guys did a fabulous.
Cheryl, I'd like to weigh in. This is Alex. And as I'm listening to the discussion and appreciating the complexities related to workflow data capture by the clinicians into the EHR, which we're actually flowing data in blobs of text that can't be effectively processed, if I'm tracking with all of Ram's commentary along with yours, Cheryl, in that I'm starting to wonder if we need a guiding principle or some aspect related to guiding principles or ideal state tied to the workflow capture, because I think this is, we systems are great at exchanging codified discrete data elements, but we as humans don't think that way. And how on the fly, when you're in that interaction with your patient and your clinicians, that data is getting captured into an EHR, and ultimately to reduce burden and increase automation, we've got to think about that aspect. So that was just a takeaway I observed from that last discussion, and I may have prompted some other commentary.
Yeah, I think that's a really
good point.
Okay. I'll move over to that. All right, Anil?
Yeah, no, I don't remember which group I made this comment to, but I think it relates back to exactly what we're discussing, which is that the entire aspect of prior authorization is not done in a vacuum. And if we're not looking at the full way that clinicians are making decisions, so the comment about, well, you know, a lot of things that might be important are not going to be in a computable form. They're not going to be structured. They're not going to be accessible in a way that's machine readable. It's very true. But I would argue that if it's important to make a decision about whether something is going to be covered or not, it's just as important from a clinical decision support and therefore should be computable in the context of the EHR. So I think one of the guiding principles that I would recommend that we include is that prior authorization should not be considered an activity done in a vacuum, but should be examined in the context of the way that a clinician and their patients are making decisions. And, you know, meaning that it should relate to the clinical decision support system. It should relate to the way that patients want transparency of what's happening with their care. It should relate to how a clinician might create a care plan. I don't know the best way to say that from a standards point of view, but the idea being that this cannot be done in a vacuum. It needs to all connect together. Otherwise, we'll have created yet another problem.
Okay, I'm going to add something to the guiding principles that we can go over for next, when we meet next, when we have this on the agenda to go over. But I do think we need to add those because I think those are really key points, and that's part of the struggle. I mean, when you're looking at prior authorizations, we're doing a pilot right now with wound care, and even standardizing images is an issue. So, you know, things of that nature all need to be talked about. So, all right, Jocelyn?
I think that this is a really important point, and I think that both Anil and Alex did a good job of sort of bringing it to sort of what I have found is that we have automated, and it's manual automation, inside of the heads of all of the nurses inside of all of our care settings across the country, that they have programmatically deconstructed the UM requirements of all of the payers in the country for the ones that they care about and that they have to service. And we can't undersell, I think, the point that Anil just made, which is we don't code things into EHRs and into patient records to get approval for prior authorization. And that work, that computing today, is done inside the brains of the nurses and the MAs that are submitting the PAs. And that to get to automation, there has to be a leap between what's in the EHR and what you need to describe what's happened to the patient's journey, and the patient's state for approval today, and that we need to figure out how to reduce that burden. People don't code for PA approval, they code for patient care and for medical records, right? So I think to me that we can't lose that, because otherwise you end up implementing things that won't succeed because we're taking out sort of the years of investment that individual nurses and MAs have created around expertise on how to get PAs approved. It's just reality.
Okay. So I think that's a really valid point. Very valid. Any other questions or comments on either this point or any of the others that were made today on the data classes? I think the representation is really very helpful, and I think we'll be able to utilize this as a reference in our ongoing work. So I think this is excellent. I know we're getting very close to the when we have our open discussion for the public comment. Any other questions or comments before we move to that? All right, Lauren, can we move to public comment early? We might as well put the slide up.
Sure, yep. We are doing that now. So while we are letting folks dial in, just remind everyone that you do have the ability to provide comments in the public comment chat feature in the box there. So if at any point you don't have time to provide comment or dial in at the scheduled time, feel free to submit your comment there as well. And with this, I will ask the operator to open the public line.
Thank you. If you would like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment while we pull for comments. There are no comments at this time.
Wonderful. All right, well, why don't we then move to, we wanted to do a brief outline of what we had in mind for next week's call. Let me open that slide while we keep the public comment slide open. And I don't know, Alex, if you want to take that or you want me to take it.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. I've been sort of working on the demos. So one of the things that we were envisioning based upon some prior discussions is that to aid our work moving forward, it might be helpful to see what's actually happening in the industry today to better understand the current state and the needs. And so we've had some discussions around specialty drug ordering, the Da Vinci Project, maybe even CMS's document record lookup service, DRLS rollout that uses some of the Da Vinci use cases. So what we've done, thanks to some extensive support from Jocelyn, is to identify different players in the industry who might be helpful and actually built on a public comment made at the last meeting. So we are looking at having some pharmacy-related presentations on April 28th. It looks like SureScripts and CoverMyMeds will be giving us some information from their view in the industry on current state and advancing standards capabilities. And then we're looking to focus on the medical prior authorization on May 5th, possibly with some Da Vinci implementing members. We're looking for folks that are really rolling up their sleeves and making this stuff real in the marketplace. So we are working on having those demos slated for 4/28 and 5/5. We are thinking that I don't want to keep moving along if we're have any public comments coming in. If not, I'd like to advance to our next step slides, which I believe start on slide 13.
Yeah, 13.
Okay, so I talked about the demos, which was slide 12. Slide 13 would be, so why we're queuing ourselves up to have demonstrations to find out what's happening in the marketplace. We will need to continue our work. Specifically, we would love to have individuals or small group meetings really go take a look at the tabs in the workbook and give us feedback by the close of business this week. Friday the 24th. Really, we're looking for us to be able to advance the data categories work and as well as the ideal state and guiding principles tabs in particular. You're more than welcome to look at the other tabs. If you have some commentary you'd like to add there, that'd be great. But we also, in addition to getting your thought leadership of to advance the respective tabs, we really are looking to see if you have any thoughts about some of the challenges and possible solutions that we might want to consider as we move into the next phase. We do have the goal of creating recommendations, not just around prior auth, but also to extrapolate those up to the larger concept of the intersection of clinical and administrative data, and that will be the basis for our full scope of recommendations, which we really need to start working on by the end of May. to that end, we're thinking we need to revisit the conversation around the additional use cases. We started out with the wheelchair DME kind of example and moved ourselves into the revised table that we saw today from Josh. But we're wondering if we really need to think about the other additional use cases. And so we wanted to cue that up, that we thought by the middle of May, we really had to have our arms around that. Cheryl, do you want to make some additional comments?
No, I think you said it very well, Alex. I really appreciate everybody's contribution so far. I think, you know, we have a great start to where we want to go. And, you know, we don't want to lose any momentum. So, you know, with the demos that we have coming forward, we'll continue reviewing the material, and hopefully there will be some time either in the next meeting or full group meeting or the meeting after that where we can finish your other considerations. And then we'll also look at the recommendations that are out there. But please take a look at those tabs in particular as well and make any additional comments to what's already been put there or any additional suggestions that you might have in new cells. Thank you, Alex.
With that said, I think we've got a few minutes left in the call. Are there any questions or comments from task force members?
Alex, I put one comment in the chat box. It's Jocelyn. Do we?
Yeah, the one about the STABIT workflow next. That's
yeah,
a comment
I feel
you're
like
talking about.
I feel like
we need
to draw some pictures.
Okay, yeah, because I wasn't sure what you were thinking there, Josh. So you think we need to draw some pictures? We started out with pictures, and we moved away from them.
Right.
And so I'm just trying to think about what's pulling you back to picture land.
I think it's when we're starting to talk about how you'd apply the different potential solutions in the market. I think you really need to think about who's involved where in what workflow, and even that sort of like easy, medium, hard sort of component. I don't know, Ram, if you want to add some color here. We were going back and forth in our discussion on Thursday and Monday about this.
Yeah, this was about 10, 15 years ago, we wrote a report, and I sent it to Jocelyn. If you're interested, I can send it to
you. I have not read it yet.
Okay, so Jocelyn, why don't you have a look at it and see if it's appropriate, then we can talk later.
And we can share it with this group. Okay.
Yeah.
So you can put a pause on it then, Alex. We'll come back.
Okay.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, but I do think that there's something very apropos about thinking about getting to the actor level to try to help us in the workflow and start to think about what our recommendations might end up meaning. I think that's kind of where you're headed.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay. Awesome.
Well, could going back to the workflows validate and elucidate how we use the data in each step? Sort of a reality check. You know, we have this grid, but if we were to map out a workflow and at each point talk about what data would be available, how it would be transported, where the gaps are.
Well, we certainly have the workflows that we started with that we can use as a reality check, as you mentioned. And so, you know, if that's one of the things we want to do in the future. I don't see any reason why we wouldn't do that, but there's probably going to be a few weeks off before we can get to that with all the things now that we have teed up for next week and the week after. So
you know what,
probably,
Cheryl,
I
think that if you don't mind, I'll poke the Surescripts and the CoverMyMeds folks a little bit too to talk about sort of why we've seen so much success in the retrospective prior auth, the ones that come out of pharmacy versus the ones that come from the providers directly, because I think that gets exactly at the point that was just made about sort of who has the right data to make it actionable to actually get the prior auth done at a given point in time. I think really will show sort of in the real world today, sort of who is the actor that can really get all the right information to get the PA approved. Versus sort of an idealized view, I think that people want us to get to tomorrow.
All right, that sounds great. Any other questions or comments before we close?
I think this has been another productive call. I think that the small group members deserve an additional applause for all their in-between meeting work. It's greatly appreciated, and I know the group I've been working with, I'll be reaching out to schedule our next meeting and appreciate the ongoing input from the full task force.
Absolutely agree with that, Alex, 100%. I mean, Jim and Joshua and Ram and Jocelyn working on the small group of the data classes, you know, really it's made a huge difference in terms of our ability to see this in a more meaningful way. So thank you very, very much. All right. I think we can call it. Thanks, everybody.
Okay. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Bye.